My name is Andrew Smith, and I'm an author, broadcaster, and screenwriter with a deep background in journalism. You might know my book, Moondust, about the men who walked on the moon and where they went afterwards. This is about my new one, Devil in the Stack, A Code Odyssey. Software engineers will tell you the purpose of their art is to make the world better. One day in 2017, I began to suspect that, overall, this wasn't happening. That as algorithmic computer code flooded into the world around me, that world was growing nastier, more homogenized, binary, and economically feudal in approximate proportion. Were the two things connected? I quickly saw two possible conduits for some form of causal relationship. Pop culture had long portrayed programmers, coders, as oddballs and misfits reconfiguring society to suit themselves. Fans of the streaming show Slow Horses will know what I mean here. Was there any truth to this? Equally, the weirdness and nihilism of code's hyper-capitalist Silicon Valley incubator was easily imagined as a kind of virus reproducing itself in whatever it touched. There was also a third and more sobering possibility. Could there be something about the way we compute, something hidden in the code itself, that is innately at odds with the way humans have evolved to be? I knew the only way to find out would be to dive into the machine, into what I came to think of as the microcosmos, by learning to code myself. Over a by turns terrifying and thrilling 5-year period, during which there were many points I feared I simply didn't have the right kind of mind for code, I did. Here are 5 key lessons I learned. 1. The way we compute is deeply eccentric. The world's first computer went to work for codebreakers at the British Government Code and Cipher School in Bletchley Park during World War II. The machine, affectionately known as Colossus, was designed and built not by Alan Turing, but by a brilliant post office engineer named Tommy Flowers, to a specification Turing floated in the 1930s. The machine did as much as anything or anyone to win the war for the Allies. This is where the story of computing gets interesting. Because Colossus and its powerful US successor, the ENIAC machine, were built hurriedly with materials and techniques available to engineers in the 1940s. All that followed built on their legacy, each essentially consisting of a calculator attached to a clock, with every third tick of the clock triggering one cycle of calculation. The objects of these calculations were streams of binary numbers, generated by vacuum tubes functioning as switches, with off representing a zero and on a one. In the general purpose computers we use today, these numbers may be used to represent things in the human realm. The number 60 might symbolize the note middle C in a musical composition, for instance. But because microprocessors can only process the world in precise binary terms, the system is brittle, convoluted, and inefficient, and tends to de-emphasize complexity. As Winston Churchill noted, nature never draws a line without smudging it, and our present computers do not cope well with smudge. This is not to diminish computing's achievements. As I burrowed deeper into the machine, I came to regard the digital edifice now surrounding us as perhaps humanity's greatest collective act of creativity to date. Nonetheless, nature is a far more subtle and resilient processor of information than anything humans are likely to develop soon. And some significant digital pioneers recognized as much. Notably, the Hungarian-American genius John von Neumann, after whom our classical computing architecture is erroneously named, was already thinking beyond the Turing paradigm by the time of his regrettably premature death, and appears to have assumed that subtler ways to compute would be found as new materials and concepts became available. He would be astonished to find that, so far, they haven't. 2. Code's striking diversity problem may in fact be a neurological problem. By most reasonable estimates, somewhere between 5 and 10% of professional coders are female. This affects both the software that gets written and how it gets written. But in the course of submitting to 2 fMRI brain scans with teams of neuroscientists trying to understand how the brain treats this newest form of input, I came to suspect that in many contexts, coders are being actively, if unconsciously, selected for left hemispheric cerebral bias. What do I mean by this? Simplified greatly, the left hemisphere processes tasks requiring close attention to detail, where the right is more broadly focused. Taking the example of natural language, syntax is most ably processed in the left hemisphere, which thrives on tight combinatorial logic, where higher functions like metaphor and humor are recognized and processed solely in the right, which tends to understand the world in terms of relationships rather than abstraction. Left hemispheric dominance is statistically far more common in men, which is related to autism also being at least 4 times more common in men. In an ideal world, there would be a more or less equal balance between the hemispheres at both the micro individual level and the macro or corporate level. Collectively, the tech firmament bears all the hallmarks of what the neuroscientist and psychiatrist Ian McGilchrist characterizes as right hemisphere damage. 3. For all tech's problems, coders have a huge amount to teach us. In my 50s and with no technical background, I found code deeply uncomfortable at first. Began to suspect that only a certain kind of coding mind could process its binary logic happily. In addition, I worried that the alien, linear mental patterns I was being forced to internalize would inhibit the lateral, imaginative motion of my pre-coding mind. In reality, the opposite was true. To code well requires empathy and imagination as much as logic, and an insufficiency of these human qualities underlies most of the more destructive code we see. In addition, code's extraordinary open-source development system depends on an almost utopian assumption that, by default, people want to help each other, and a rising tide lifts all boats. Cooperation, communication, and concern for others are written into the structure and culture of programming languages like Python and Ruby. These days, I frequently find myself at coding events thinking, why can't the whole world work this way? 4. In the current computing paradigm, we may never see artificial general intelligence. What we call AI is not AI. It is machine learning. From the 1950s onward, computerists have promised that true AI is just around the corner, simultaneously overstating their own powers and underestimating biology's. The more closely we study rays, cuttlefish, bees, our own extraordinary brains, the clearer it becomes that our machines are not even close to acquiring comparable abilities. In truth, large language model AI bots like ChatGPT may be moving us further away from general intelligence, not closer to it. At present, AI is best understood as a marketing term, which is why I now feel less concerned about the arrival of superintelligent machines that subjugate us or turn us into pets, more fearing their ability to simulate human intelligence while being fundamentally fast but stupid, seducing us into meeting them in the middle, dissolving our intelligence into their dumbness on a promise of convenience. It's easy to suspect this is already happening. 5. We came within a hair's breadth of a computing revolution in mid-Victorian England. Everything that happens inside a computer is predicated on a revolutionary system of logic conceived by a poor cobbler's son from Lincolnshire with no formal education, named George Boole. Boole was born in 1815, within a fortnight of Ada Lovelace, countess and daughter of the romantic poet Lord Byron, herself a brilliant mathematician and close friend of Charles Babbage, the man widely regarded as the father of computing. Lovelace is credited with having seen further into Babbage's analytical engine, which would have been the world's first programmable computer had it been built, even than Babbage himself. Between them, this trio held all the knowledge necessary to launch a computer revolution a full century before the one we're currently straining to accommodate. When Boole met Babbage in the Crystal Palace at the Great Exhibition of London in 1851, the conceptual circuit was completed. At this point, the possibility of Victorian digital revolution becomes tangible. Sadly, Ada and Boole both died young. While gender and class stratifications kept them out of the English Academy, where they might have worked more formally with Babbage. Whether this was a good or bad thing for humanity, only time will tell. But it is intriguing to consider. Of course, this barely scratches the surface of what's in Devil in the Stack, in which I do find an explanation for why code might be abrading us as a society. Thanks for listening.